This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today, from the studios of KSFR at Santa Fe Community College, is author Johnny D. Boggs, a native of Timminsville who has spent most of his adult life in the West and become one of the country's best-known and best-recognized Western writers. But he also has written about the Carolina frontier, and that's what we're going to talk about today. His latest book, The Cane Creek Regulators, which deals with the period of South Carolina history between the Cherokee War, or the French and Indian War, if you want to give it the bigger name, and the American Revolution, when the backcountry was truly in a state of nature. And so, Johnny, with that formal introduction, welcome back to the Journal.
Thank you very much, Walter.
Let's talk a little bit about you. You grew up in Timminsville.
Right.
And came to Carolina.
Graduated University of South Carolina, majored in journalism, 1984. It's been a while since I was learning the ropes back at Carolina. But I still get back there. We called a baseball game last time I was in town.
Well, you majored in journalism, but I saw one of your thank you notes about your buddy at the Preservation Society. It sounds like you spent a lot of time down in Five Points, too.
I got around the state a little bit, and when I was in college, I would string. It's part-time work for sports sections and papers. I'd cover various games for the Sumter Daily Item, Florence Morning News, and other newspapers. And so I traveled across the state quite a bit.
And when you graduated, you immediately went into journalism. First at the Dallas Times Herald, but that's no longer with us, is it?
No, it ceased publication in December of 1991. I remember that pretty well. We had bought our first house, moved in on December 7th, and on December 8th, my first phone call in the first house I ever owned was a friend of ours at the Dallas Morning News saying, we just bought your newspaper and we're shutting you down.
Oh, so December the 8th was, you know, you moved in on Pearl Harbor Day, and the next day you got a phone call.
Well, the other thing was the house was built in 1941, so we joked before that, said, you know, I don't know about this, you know. But it worked out well, and one thing it taught me was that, you know, you can give it all to your newspaper, but, you know, there's no guarantee you're going to be publishing the next day, especially now. Now, today, it's even worse. And it kind of made me go out, and since I was, you know, collecting unemployment and the severance package I got, I started going out and freelancing for various magazines. And I also decided, you know, a friend of mine who had written a couple of books, he said, hey, you got all this time now, why don't you start a novel? And that was kind of the motivating factor there. I started a novel. Now, it took me like 3.5 years to finish that novel, and eventually it even got published. But that was kind of the – I'd always thought about doing it. I always wanted to do it. I'd written some short stories for some anthologies and small magazines, small literary magazines and stuff like that. And I always – the idea, even when I went into journalism and newspaper journalism – it was that I eventually wanted to write books and eventually wanted to write basically historical novels. So I guess I can thank the Dallas Morning News for closing my newspaper and motivating me a little bit to get off my butt and get with it.
Well, I noticed that among the magazines you've written for is Boy's Life, and I found out last week in the barbershop in Five Points that Boy's Life is actually still published.
Yes.
I grew up taking Boy's Life. It was, if you were a Cub Scout and a Boy Scout, that was kind of something that you did.
Yeah, so do I. And my son is 13 years old now. He's a scout, and he gets the magazine too. And occasionally they'll even have me do some stuff for them.
Well, hey, but then I quickly moved on to Argosy and True, and those were, those were more adult magazines for teenagers in my time. But growing up in South Carolina, I know you love South Carolina history. Francis Marion is one of your great heroes. But how did you get hooked on the West?
It was probably, well, for one thing, it was the West and what I saw of it on Gunsmoke and James Stewart and John Wayne and Randolph Scott movies on TV and all. it was a long way from the swamps and the tobacco fields where I grew up. You know, I was growing up at the tail end of the Western TV boom. I mean, you could still see Gunsmoke. The Virginian was on when I was a kid and things, shows like that. And so I just kind of got interested in it. And my dad always told me the story that, and I barely even remember the TV series, but it was Sugarfoot, which was kind of a tongue-in-cheek little Western, based on actually a pretty good movie called The Boy from Oklahoma. And the main character, he was a tenderfoot, and they call him even lower than a tenderfoot, he was a sugarfoot. But his real name was Tom Brewster. And my dad would tell me that, you know, there were times when they'd be calling me into supper, and I wouldn't answer if they called me by Johnny. But so eventually they'd have to say, "Hey, Tom Brewster, come on in for supper," and then I'd come. So I don't remember that, but I don't think my dad would lie too much. But so I had this idea of the West and what it was. And when I was majoring in journalism, most of the newspapers I applied for were out West. And I was just lucky enough that the Dallas Times-Herald at the time was doing a massive hiring and expansion program, and they needed some young, sports, cheap journalists. And so I hooked on there. So it was just kind of a dream come true.
Johnny, you said there were lots of opportunities out West, and 1984 you went out there, they were expanding, and 7 years later they folded. I guess that tells you about the history of journalism.
Yeah, well, you know, and I left. I after the Times-Herald, I moved to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and had to work my way back up. I was assistant sports editor in charge of the night operation at the Herald when it folded. So I went back to working on the copy desk and moved up to copy desk chief and then assistant sports editor in charge of the night operation. And eventually, I'd seen so many coworkers who, you know, in sports you're working 4 p.m. basically to almost 1 a.m. So you never saw your family. And I'd seen, you know, people working the desk who you know, missed their kids, their sporting events and stuff because they had to work. And I said, I'm not sure I really want to do that. We hadn't started a family yet. My wife was working the typical 9-to-5 job, and her friends always told her that I was a figment of her imagination because they never saw me. So about 97, I'd started getting some books published, some novels published, and I was doing pretty well on the freelance on the side. And I just decided, you know, let's take a leap of faith, and let's see if I can make a living freelancing and writing novels. And as I told my wife, here's my plan. We move to New Mexico. We sell our house. We move to Santa Fe, New Mexico. You get a job at Santa Fe. I'll stay home and write full time. And she said, that's a great idea. Let's do it. And we did it. And to my surprise, I haven't had to get that day job yet. Now, people say, you make a living writing? And I always have to qualify that by, it depends on your definition of making a living.
Okay, I got that. All I can say is you sold the Pearl Harbor house, picked up, moved to Santa Fe. Is that because you felt the cultural world of Santa Fe might be more welcoming? I mean, everybody knows about certainly the music and the art in Santa Fe.
Right. Well, Santa Fe is very open and is very accepting, and there are a number of writers here. Ann Hillerman, Tony Hillerman's daughter, I know her well. David Morrell, who he always jokes that he is Rambo's daddy. He wrote First Blood and has written a number of successful thrillers and horror and even done a Western. I know a lot of artists. And you know, writing, I always say we're kind of a low form of artistry, but it is an art. If you live in Santa Fe and you're a freelance writer, that you're going to have to write about art. So, I mean, we had Indian Market last weekend, and it was just, it brings in 100,000 people and like 600 or 1,200 Indian artists and 600 booths. It's just fantastic event. I mean, parking might be a little bit of a problem, but otherwise it's just a great event. So I kind of felt more free to do this kind of deal in Santa Fe than I think I would in Dallas. And Dallas was a fun town. Fun town when you're in your 20s. Really fun when you're in your 20s and you're single. But it's also kind of, you know, set in its ways, and you have to do this and do that and do that. Follow the game plan, so to speak. And in Santa Fe, there is no game plan. It's whatever you want to make out of it.
What about back home in Timmonsville? Could you write back in or Florence or Lake City? Or
I think I'd be writing different things. I mean, I've done some short stories, quasi-contemporary short stories that were published that were, you know, more or less pseudo-autobiographical, I guess. The thing what I found when I was writing, and, you know, I knew I wanted to write kind of genre fiction, and I knew that, and Westerns are kind of even, you know, even the lowest form of genre fiction a lot of times when you're getting that respect. You know, mysteries and fantasy and science fiction, they're kind of accepted in the mainstream, but Westerns and romance are kind of like the ugly stepchild. And when I was taking writing classes and stuff at the University of South Carolina, I found a lot of people, they wanted to be the next William Faulkner. Well, you know, I'm not going to be the next William Faulkner. And as much as I love Go Down Moses, I don't think I could ever write like that. I felt a little more fresh, a little more me in writing about the American frontier and the American West. Now, I still go back to South Carolina, and what I've found out is a lot of my characters that I'm writing about are transplanted from the Carolinas or from somewhere in the South, and they head out west, which happened quite a bit after the Civil War.
Actually, that move westward began right after the Revolution, and by 1860, more than 25% of the people who had been, according to the census, who had been born in South Carolina were living somewhere else. They had kept moving west, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Texas, and of course, eventually, after the Civil War, even further west. We've been sending folks out, and you're an example for several centuries. Always folks looking for either to better themselves or to get away. In fact, there's a document in the Carolinian Library about, it's an account book, and it said, John Smith, gone to Texas, owing me $50. May he rest in hell. You know, we talk about the Texas heroes and just having been at San Antonio, and the stories of some of the Carolina boys out there are not exactly, let's just say, they had some character flaws.
Well, yeah. Yes, but that makes them interesting, though, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And when they left their diaries, it made it even more interesting. But that's not a part of the story that you hear in San Antonio with Travis and Bonham.
Yeah, but when you read about the Alamo and you know, the fight for Texas independence, you know, a lot of those people were from South Carolina. And that always, when I was reading about the Alamo, you know, that always struck me. I said, hey, this guy's, he's one of us. I'm not sure that's a good thing, but he is one of us. But
yeah, well, yeah. Travis and Bonham, two of the heroes of the Alamo, were both South Carolinian.
Right.
Before we get into your book, you had mentioned earlier that you grew up watching TV and the end of the Western era, and since I'm about 12 years older than you are. No, actually, I'm 20 years older than you are. Sorry.
We.
You know, I remember when Gunsmoke first came on, and then it all of a sudden, prime time on all three networks, everything was Western. You had the Rifleman, you had the Virginia, Bonanza, mm-hmm. Wagon Train, mm-hmm. all of these things. But it was a Hollywood West. You don't write Hollywood West.
Yeah, and you know, I like the traditional Westerns. I like, you know, I can go back and watch an old Randolph Scott movie or read what you would call a traditional paperback Western in the Louis L'Amour vein, Max Brand and stuff like that. And those are fun to read. And I always thought, you know, one of the things that got me interested in more of the historical part, you know, I'd watch Gunsmoke or I'd watch a John Wayne movie or something like that. I'd say, that's pretty cool. But then you start reading about it and reading the actual histories of it, and that's even far more interesting than what you could get away with on TV at the time or even the movies when they had the production codes. So I always thought that was a little more fascinating. And And I like the characters that aren't, you know, 6 foot two and always do the right thing, because, you know, we don't always do the right thing. And I think the characters, like we were talking about, you know, when you read about Travis or Bonham or Rip Ford or Sam Houston, yeah, Crockett or all those, I mean, they're flawed people. And that makes them a lot more believable and a lot more interesting and a lot more fun to write about.
I've known you for more than a decade, but I went back and, you know, I did pull up your website, and that was fun, because in looking at the writers that you really admired, I think people would be amazed. Mark Twain, people don't realize he wrote about the West. I mean,
oh yeah, Roughing It.
Steinbeck.
Yeah, and I always said, you know, The Grapes of Wrath is one of the best Western novels ever written.
Alexander Dumas.
I started reading him when I was probably 12 years old, and I'd gone to see the movie. My dad took my younger sister and me to see The Three Musketeers, and I said, wow, this is really cool, swashbuckling and all this adventure. And then, we had a copy of the book, and I just picked it up and started reading it that summer. And what always appealed to me more was not necessarily the D'Artagnan and the swordplay, but it was the political intrigue and the femme fatale and things like that. And I just said, well, this is really good. And another thing I always said, you know, The Three Musketeers took me a long way from, like I said, the tobacco fields, the mosquitoes, the heat, and the humidity of South Carolina. So I think that's one of the big draws that I had with him.
Well, you mentioned that. As a child, you were from Timminsville. Did you grow up working in the fields with your family? Or?
Yes. We had a farm. My dad was a building contractor. So sometimes when I got older, I would spend summers working for him building houses. But, you know, we had a farm, so it was, you know, hoeing the garden, planting the garden, and then picking. I absolutely hated to pick okra. I can't even eat okra now. I hated it so much, unless you put it in gumbo or something like that. And then it was tobacco, you know. So, you know, I'd work sometimes in the tobacco barns. And, you know, I'd basically be handing these sticks.
Okay, let's talk about that, because some folks now don't understand. it's all changed. It's all containerized.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
You know, so you've got this tobacco barn where it's being heated in the harvest time, which is the hottest part of the summer.
That's right.
And it's over 100 degrees. The leaves have been tied onto those sticks and then hung up through the rafters.
Right. So my job, they'd bring in these trailers. A tractor would pull these trailers, and they'd be loaded down with sticks and our tobacco, and the tobacco would be tied onto the sticks. You'd pick up the stick, you'd carry it into the barn, you'd hand it up to the guy that's standing in the up, and he would take the stick of tobacco and plant and place it so it would be cured. And, you know, your hands would be so black from the tar, from the tobacco, that it would take, you know, you'd have to, you know, shower by maybe 3 or 4 times after when you got home from work. It was not fun work. But I was at a library in Kentucky some time back, and they'd asked me to do a reading, and I did a reading from a short story I wrote, which was it was an autobiographical story, but it was a little bit about a kid playing in the West, and he always played it with a tobacco stick, and the tobacco stick could be a saber, it could be his horse, it could be a Winchester 73, it could be a sword, you know, anything you wanted it to be. And then I read an excerpt from a novel, which was The Big 50, and it's about a kid who's transplanted from the Carolinas into Kansas, and he eventually winds up with a buffalo hunting outfit, but he's got a tobacco stick he brought from home, and he's using it as his Sharps Big 50 rifle. And somebody says, you have an obscene fascination with tobacco sticks.
Well, they are darn near indestructible.
They are.
I know older Carolinians who were not living in the PD, but wanted to get tobacco sticks to use in their garden, you know, stake up the plants.
Right. Right.
And by the way, okra now has been modified, however, to take the spines out so you could pick okra without getting your fingers sticky.
Oh, well, see.
It also doesn't taste quite as good as the,
I bet.
As the other stuff. So I can see where 18th century France could take you out of the tobacco fields. But then if you've got Charles Dickens down here, too, and man, to go back to Victorian England, that takes you out of the tobacco fields, but it's hardly an upper.
No, you know, Dickens did not write uppers. He was quite the downer. And you know, sometimes people read my books and they think, hey, you've got some problems you need to work out. Is there anything I need to know about you? Or, I mean, even the Cane Creek Regulators, it's not really an upbeat novel.
Well, no, and we'll get to that in just a minute. I'm having fun talking about
it. Oh, this is always fun, Walter. It's always fun.
Which is what we South Carolinians have, you know, it's personality. And you mentioned fuzz with the okra, and peach is your favorite. Dory Sanders, author from up in York County, would talk about now peaches don't have fuzz on them, but it used to be picking peaches was just as nasty because, you know, your arms would itch.
Yeah. My dad, he would always look at me funny because he could not eat a peach unless he skinned it first. He had to peel the skin off the peach before he would eat one. And when I would just, you know, bite into a peach, he'd kind of say, what are you doing, bud?
I always ran mine under water a little bit to just kind of take the worst of the fuss. But yes, I prefer to eat the peach whole. Johnny, we need to pause for a moment to let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking to Johnny D. Boggs, a native of Timmonsville, but who's become one of the country's most successful and honored Western writers, about his latest book, The Cane Creek Regulators, which is set in 18th century South Carolina. Anyway, let's get to The Cane Creek Regulators, which is set in South Carolina, in the time period between 1763 and 1775. And it's really a turbulent time. And so let's kind of set the scene for our listeners, because talking to folks today, Johnny, they jump from, yeah, they know about the French and Indian War, but it's mostly what they were doing up, you know, north, George Washington out west, and Braddock's defeat and all of that stuff.
Right.
And there's not that much known about this particular period of South Carolina history, because it all of a sudden gets into revolutionary agitation, and all of that's happening in Charleston. It's not happening in the backcountry. And I must say, looking at your bibliography, I don't think you missed any available book that was there. And of course, my absolute favorite to talk about the backcountry is Charles Wood Mason's.
Oh, yeah. So when I was reading, because I was just doing the research on that, the idea for the novel came about, and years ago, I'd come back from, I guess I was probably in Dallas, and I'd come back to South Carolina. And what any writer does when he's in anywhere, he finds a bookstore, and he goes into the bookstore, and he starts, you know, shopping. And Sanlapper Press had reprinted a copy of Robert Bass's 96, and 96 was one place I'd really never been in all my travels as a sports journalist and just, you know, getting away on vacations or just going out to see whatever. So I didn't know a whole lot about 96, but I'd read, you know, Bass's biographies of especially Francis Marion. Also, I said, well, cool, I'll pick it up. And I read it, and it was just a little line. It was just maybe a paragraph, maybe not even more than a couple of sentences, but it said that, you know, in the backcountry in the 96 area, outlaws were running rampant. They couldn't get any help from the militia down in Charleston. So they formed a militia to put down the outlaws. And then what happened was they put down the outlaws successfully, but then the militia got so out of hand, the citizens had to rise up and put down the militia. And that just struck me as, wow, there is a story there. And I just, you know, wrote it down and filed it on my computer as a, you know, an idea for a novel down the road. And eventually I said, you know, I want to tackle this now. So, but when I was reading Wood Mason, and he was kind of like the itinerant preacher who's going from community to community, and he wrote a memoir about it. And And so I, when I read about him, I said, well, he's got to be a character in this novel.
I'm going to flesh out a little bit of the history for.
Okay.
Because at the end of, we'll just call it the French and Indian War in 1763, the Carolina backcountry was very fragile. There had been Indian raids. There had been the massacre at Long Canes, for an example, when the Indians attacked a settler's, actually a wagon train, and pretty much killed everybody, men, women, and children. And so the society was pretty fragile. The Cherokee had been beaten, but society itself, people had abandoned their homes actually to move closer to the coast down to places like Orangeburg and Lexington and what have you to escape. And when they abandoned their homesteads, it sort of got by. Somebody came to buy an abandoned homestead and something there they liked, they just kind of got in the habit of walking away with it, whether it was a tool or piece of furniture or what have you. And so there was pretty much a general lawlessness, not just on the Carolina frontier, but really the whole southern frontier from South Carolina, you could say from Long Canes, which is in Abbeville County, all the way up through the Shenandoah Valley. And those outlaw gangs were extremely well organized. When I was teaching South Carolina history, I would explain it this way to students. If you had your Toyota parked out there and it got stolen, where do you think, what do you think would happen? It would be hanging around here. Somebody said, no, it would probably be either shipped to Miami, up 95 down Miami, or up 95 to the north and sold. I said, well, that was what the outlaws were doing. With, they would steal cattle or horses in South Carolina and run them up to Virginia and sell them, and vice versa. They'd steal stuff there and fence them back in South Carolina. And no respectable or hardworking citizen was really safe in his or her home, and you've captured that beautifully. And they begged for help. I mean, they petitioned, they begged. And when they finally did get a little bit of law enforcement, and you've got it in your book, they captured some of the evildoers, and they were sent to Charleston. Well, they got a new British governor, and he thought when he got there, the best thing he could do would be to pardon everybody, which he did. And what made the law enforcement so difficult is all of the courts were in Charleston. If you had a problem, whether it was criminal or civil, say you wanted to file daddy's will or you wanted to record a deed, you had to go to Charleston to do it. And you're talking about almost a week's travel in those days, one way. So they really were remote. And eventually, as you say, when the outlaws in the mid-1760s really went on rampages, and the stories are graphic. In fact, you kind of pulled your punches. Some of the stories I have seen, you'd have gotten a triple X rating for your book.
Yeah, that's true. I'm writing for, you know, a general audience here. I don't want to offend too many people.
Well, I mean, it really got bad, that the torture, rape, murder, I mean, it was pretty gruesome. And so, as you say, they formed a vigilante group.
Which was illegal.
Of course it's illegal. Yeah. And the government in Charleston is saying the outlaws are the victims, and the people who are trying to preserve law and order are the bad guys. You want to take it from there?
Sure, sure. So that's the historic part of the story. And then what I wanted to do is just put, you know, a family in 96. And then the main character I wanted to make it was a girl. She's probably 15 or 16 when the novel opens. And, you know, she's caught picking berries in the woods by some people, and she manages to escape that, and that riles up her father, who runs a tavern in the in 96, and they start petitioning and seeing nothing happening, no luck, and the outlaws are still running rampant, and eventually, you know, her father has to form the vigilante group and put down the outlaws, which he does. But then his son, who's got some baggage, when his father eventually, the son will take over, and then And that's when things get totally out of hand, when he starts for imagined crimes or just misdemeanors, and you know the punishment goes way extreme. And then so the daughter, Emily Stewart, she's going to have to, you know, take a stand against her brother. I guess it's kind of Freudian, kind of Shakespearean, just about everything. But it's also Western, because this same thing is going to happen. I mean, we always say we read about history so we don't repeat ourselves, but history is always repeating itself. And the same thing's going to happen out West over and over again. Vigilantes are going to have to rise up against the outlaws. And then this inner turmoil between, you know, what happens in later. I mean, this is kind of a prequel to what's going to happen in the Revolutionary War. We got patriots against Tories, and that was just savage. That was as savage as what was happening out, you know, in this period in the 1760s. And it's going to repeat itself in Missouri during the Civil War, and the Kansas-Missouri border wars. So it's a Western. It's just a Western set in South Carolina.
People don't often think of South Carolina as a frontier state, but it was. Even when Charleston was settled, it was the southern frontier of British North America. When you talk about Emily's brother taking over and things go bad, eventually the regulators and the government in Charleston worked out some things. A couple of companies of regulators were actually commissioned as rangers to take care of the bad guys, which they did. But then they began to say, well, you know, Jack over there, he drinks too much and doesn't really take care of his wife. We need to discipline him. And they actually used terms like riffraff and lower sort. And, oh, by the way, did you know that Emily's dad didn't do it, but frequently people who owned taverns fenced stolen goods.
Oh, that's true.
And so they would discipline them. And the discipline, as you pointed out, got carried away. We're talking about 50 or 100 lashes, which sometimes could bring people close to death.
Right.
And it became a party, a reason to bring out the booze. You whip him, ride him on a rail, which was certainly not a very comfortable punishment for a person. So you've got a group that came up to oppose the regulators. And it looked like there was going to be full civil war in the backcountry. And then General Richard Richardson and a few other strong guys knocked some heads together, and the situation dissipated, and you more or less had peace from about 1770 till at least the Revolution. As you pointed out, it's a story that's been repeated as the frontier moved west. You know, what was interesting to me in your setting up of your characters is Emily's mother comes from a very fine Georgetown County family, basically a planter family.
Sure.
And marries this young Scot, who's going to take her off to his wife off to the frontier. But they never lose their connection, and that's an important thread in the story.
Right. Yeah, there's always a connection, and you know, I always say, you know, that's probably me too, because I write about the West, but you know, I'm always pulled back to, you know, she crab soup and shrimp and grits and pork barbecue. So,
well, you mentioned okra. You hadn't forgotten that out in Mexico.
No. I would like to forget the okra. That's all right.
I really want to talk about Western writers and who is considered a Western writer. We've already mentioned Twain and certainly his short stories. Everybody thinks about the Mississippi, but his short stories are set out west.
Jumping Frog, of course, one that made him famous. That's California in the Gold Rush. So,
Bret Hart. I mean, all of those.
Bret Hart, yeah, they were Western writers. And like I said, I always said Steinbeck, he's writing about California, but he's writing about the West. Maybe the Red Pony is the only one you might identify as a Western, but I think you can see Western themes and Western elements in most of his writing, and especially The Grapes of Wrath. I said, you know, that's about the really last great big westward migration. It just happens in the Dust Bowl. It's not your typical Western, but he was a Western writer. I mean, I'm kind of loose on, you know, a lot of people and a lot of publishers. I mean, I have fights with publishers trying to get One of the things I really enjoyed about writing for Five Star was they would let me occasionally go back to my Carolina roots and write about the frontier. I mean, we think of the frontier, we think of the West as west of the Mississippi, and we think of Westerns set between, you know, 1860 to about 1900, and that is the American West. But, you know, the American West really began when the first European settlers arrived on the Atlantic coast, and it gradually moved. The frontier line gradually moved, and when I'm writing about in the 1760s, yeah, 96 South Carolina is the frontier. It is the West. It is west of civilization. Civilization is Charleston. Civilization is on the coast.
You know, Johnny, back to the question of who is a Western writer, or actually the bigger question, Southern writer. I mean, we talked about people don't think of Twain or Steinbeck or even maybe Jack London.
Right.
I always thought of him as sort of a, you know, I read him along with My Boy's Life.
Sure.
You know, White Fang.
He actually wrote for Boy's Life, if you believe that. He wrote a short story for Boy's Life magazine in about 1911 or something like
but
that.
But then
yeah.
You look at Larry McMurtry and, of course, Lonesome Dove.
Right.
That I understand. But one thing that keeps coming through to me from our conversation is you grew up, even though you grew up with the Western from TV, you grew up understanding South Carolina history, which you very quickly realized, or you realized over the course of your professional life, was a general American story.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Now, explain for our listeners what the Spur Award is.
Spur Award has been given out since the 1950s from Western Writers of America, which is a group of, right now its number is probably between 600 and 700 professional writers of the West. That's screenplays, poetry, songs, novels, nonfiction, anything Western related. So every year since, I think, 1953, they have awarded Spur Awards for what in different categories: best Western novel, best Western nonfiction book, best Western short story, short nonfiction article. Right now, I think the number of categories total in the teens, 16, 17, or something like that. So every year they get a group of judges in different categories. It's free submission. And, you know, the judges, three judges, will vote on what they think is the best in their category, whether it's historical novel or biography or screenplay or whatever. And it's a prestigious honor. And
I'm looking at this. Has been going on now for about 60 years, and you've won it six times. So that means you've won it 10% of the time. Here's a boy from Timminsville. I mean, that's...
I never thought about it that way, but I guess, yeah.
I'm going to talk about some of the titles. Well, the books that won aren't nearly as interesting as some of the titles. Greasy Grass was nominated but didn't win.
It was a finalist, right, which is a high honor in itself. I mean, there are only like two or three finalists each year. Greasy Grass, let me explain. Greasy Grass is the Lakota name for the Little Bighorn.
Oh.
So that's a novel about the Little Bighorn told in multiple first-person viewpoints from Lakotas, from Cheyenne, from Cavalry soldiers, and even a few civilians. So.
I guess looking at American literature, and I did take literature as one of my fields, undergraduate and graduate, I did a lot of it, but the titles just scream Western to me. Camp Ford. Doubtful Canyon, Hard Winter, Legacy for a Lawman, West Texas Kill. Now, your short story, the title's A Piano at Dead Man's Crossing. What's that about?
It's a story of about 50 years of a frontier family told from the viewpoint of the family's upright piano.
Okay. All right. Speak for the.
I got the idea. I mean, it's a serious story. I got the idea. I was on a cattle drive years ago in Arizona, and we're sitting around. I mean, cattle drives, you think of it romantic, and I was on this for a magazine assignment. It's anything but romantic. It's hard work. You're in the saddle all day, and it's just, you know, it's miserable. It's absolutely a miserable way to make a living. And I was glad I was just on that for the 4 or 5 days on the cattle drive. But we were sitting around the campfire, and this woman started telling the story. And she said, you know, they came down to a homestead down in northeastern Arizona, and they found this old abandoned homestead. And inside, she said, was the piano. And then she told me, imagine the stories that piano could tell. And I said, bing. So I said, that's the story I want to write. And eventually I wrote it. And that was actually my first Spur Award. It was published in an anthology, a collection of 20 short stories, and I still think it's one of the best things I've ever written.
Johnny, have you got a copy of your book with you by any chance?
I do.
All right. How about reading a couple of passages for us?
All right. We'll just open it up right here. This is the first chapter. This is how I opened it. Emily ran. She wanted to scream but didn't think she had enough breath. Besides, what was the use? Hours earlier, she had crossed Spring Branch and traveled so far down the Cherokee path that, when the renegades surprised her, no one back in 96 could have heard her. Even the warblers and grasshopper sparrows that had been singing that morning had flown away. The 3 men had startled her, silently appearing from behind a giant Oglethorpe oak on the other side of the trail. 2 wore beards and greasy buckskins, while the other was clean-shaven, all dangerous. All carried hatchets and knives in their belts, and each held a rifle. She's a devilish good piece, the one with the leather eye patch had said. When they surprised her, Emily had been on her knees beside a ditch, filling a tin pail with blueberries. She had almost screamed, but the fat man with the blubbery cheeks had brought a finger to his lips, smiling, telling her, "Keep your breath to cool your porridge." That had stopped her from crying out. That and the fact that the third man, the tall, dark one donning a ribbon shirt and the calico turban of the Cherokees, had tossed his long rifle to eye patch and slowly, noiselessly, moved toward her, his eyes as hypnotic as a rattlesnake's. So that's how it opens. She's in a bit of a bind.
Well, I think the opening to chapter 2 is pretty good, too, because it's Emily's dad's statement of the situation.
There you go. That's good. Breck Stewart, who was a fine character to write about. You know, a good Scotsman. All right, so chapter 2. "We are descendants of freeborn Britons," Breck Stewart said. "Loyal to the crown, yet we find ourselves in a state of barbarism and degeneracy, and often at the mercy of the profligate, impudent, and audacious horse thieves, cattle stealers, hog stealers, and such bold and dangerous scoundrels who hold all order and decency in contempt." Don and Stuart, Emily's older brother, leaned over, giving her a nudge, and whispered, "When shall Di put up the basket? He has been talking for an hour already." Emily shoved him away. "Don't be such a noodle," she said, softly but sharply. Don often acted silly, though he more often came across as surly. She tried to remind herself that her brother meant well, was not complaining, but rather was merely trying to make Emily relax, maybe even smile, hoping to get her mind off what had happened in the woods that morning. Or maybe he was just bored. She wasn't sure she could hold that against him. For months, probably for better than a year now, they had been listening to their father state the same case over and over. Nothing more than words. It was only just a month ago that they had gathered the settlers at the tavern after Alroy O'Finnegan's barn had been burned to make his same argument. But today seemed different. Breck Stewart sounded different, and Emily had never seen him so angry, his face a heated red, his ears even darker, his eyes flamed with a hatred that frightened her almost as much as those 3 Blackhearts in the woods. So there we go.
And this is the beginning of the Cane Creek Regulators.
Right.
All right, Johnny, what's your next project?
A editor at Kensington Books, which does mass market paperbacks, asked me to write a sequel to the novel that the copyright expired, that became the movie, the John Wayne Western Red River. So it's Return to Red River. That's what I'm working on right now. And I thought that was kind of intriguing. First of all, it was intriguing on one say when he approached me and said, can you write a sequel to Red River? And the novel's a lot different than the film version that starred John Wayne and Montgomery Clift. And
that's
Joanna
not
Green.
That's not surprising, is it?
No, it's not surprising. It's not surprising. But my thought there was, well, there's a little thing called copyright. And he goes, we're pretty sure it's out of copyright that Borden Chase, the author, never renewed the copyright. I mean, copyright laws were a lot different when this novel was first written in the 1940s. So, but he had to turn it over to legal. The legal department at the publisher had to go through everything to make sure that it was okay to write a sequel to the novel. And the challenge there is most people haven't read the novel. They're familiar with the movie. So you've got to kind of work it in. But the one thing I said I don't want to do is have John Wayne's and Howard Hawks and United Artists coming after me. So I've got to make clear that this is a sequel to the novel and not the movie. But yeah, it's kind of a fun project. And after that, I've got a novel coming out next year, which is kind of a young adult traditional Western called Top Soldier, and it's about a Civil War vet and his son kind of re-familiarizing themselves after 4 years absence in the war, and that's set in Texas.
Well, you've written two books about the Carolinas. You got any more that you might want to?
I keep thinking I'd like to do one of, I mean, one thing I have to do, I mean, I have to be careful. I mean, like I said, most publishers today, you know, don't believe that argument that I say that the West was really began in the Carolinas. Look at Drums Along the Mohawk. I mean, that's upstate New York, but that's a Western too. And James Fenimore Cooper, I mean, he was writing about that area and that era, and people who identify him as Westerns. But publishers today, they want a cowboy with a six-shooter and a Winchester and a cowboy hat and a horse.
Why don't you remind them historically that the term cowboy comes out of 17th century South Carolina?
That's right. I always say, I said, cowpens. You know what it was?
Well, and also the first cattle drives in America took place in South Carolina.
That's right. That's right, when they were herding them there. So. And there's you're giving me another idea there for a novel, a South Carolina cattle drive story.
Okay.
But I thought about doing the Cherokee uprising, and I've even thought, you know, going way back and maybe even try something on the Yemassee War. But
anyway, you're obviously a Carolina boy who your roots show, even though you're now living in Santa Fe.
Well, here's what I'm doing next. My next project isn't anything to do with writing. I took some theater classes in Carolina in acting, and a friend of mine asked me to take a part in a play. The play is Larry Shue's The Foreigner. It's going to open in October at Santa Fe Playhouse, and he asked me if I could do that. So I had to, you know, audition for the part. And had to read twice, and then I thought I'd blown it, and he called me up and offered me the job. It's a two-act comedy, and I play the redneck property inspector from North Georgia who has a side job with the KKK. But he's also said, now, can you help out the other actors with their Southern accents? I think that's why he hired me.
Well, you know, you may have been living in Santa Fe for the last 15 years, but you still sound like you come out of the PD. you can't take the boy out of it.
I know.
Well,
which is a good thing, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Well, any last words for our listeners, Johnny?
Hey, it's always a pleasure, and you know, I plugged your book too. Yeah, in this novel too, at the end, because you know South Carolina history, I still go to quite often.
Well, thank you, and Johnny D. Boggs, Timmonsville native and noted Western writer. Thanks so much for being with us today on the Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I did. I've known Johnny D. Boggs for a while. He's been on the show before. and he's just a hoot. I mean, his life, how he became first a journalist and then a writer, and he always keeps coming back to the stories and the history of his native state and how that has influenced him. It's quite a story in itself. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal. Next time on Walter Edgar's Journal, my guest will be Maureen D. Lee, who's written a biography of Cicerita Jones, the greatest singer of her race, 1868 to 1933.
He got her a position as the star soprano. They called it a three-day Grand Negro Jubilee at Madison Square Garden. All these important people in New York came, and she absolutely wowed them.
Join me for Walter Edgar's Journal, a production of South Carolina Public Radio, Friday at noon.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.